The White House budget request lays out a plan to get rid of sequestration and start new programs to strengthen the senior executive service. But the power over budget reality, of course, lies mostly in the hands of Congress. Larry Allen's president of Allen Federal Business Partners and writes the Week Ahead newsletter. And he says that you and your company should be wary of the hype a White House budget creates. I debate this, Larry, with my colleague Jason Miller every single year. We start around the middle of January when he starts to get the hives from budgets coming. You know, he's probably the biggest federal budget geek that I know, and kudos to him, because it's really important stuff. But we go through this every January. The budget's coming out. How much should we talk about it? And of course, he's just over the moon about it. And I'm a little bit more passive than I should be. And it seems like what you're suggesting in the newsletter this week is that maybe people shouldn't be as lackadaisical about it as I am, especially in the contracting community, but maybe they don't want to freak out like Jason does.
Putting aside for a moment the fact that we know Jason leads a very exciting life, the fact is that some years the president's budget request is worth paying more attention to than in others. So some years the budget request deserves some of the attention that it gets, but I don't think that this year is one of those years, Francis, primarily because the budget wasn't really in its entirety a fiscal economic document. A lot of it was positioning the president's party for 2016, and also the reality is that both chambers of Congress are now controlled by the Republicans, who are going to be able to put an increased footprint on what they think spending ought to look like, whereas in previous years, even when you had one chamber in one side, one chamber in the other, you know, there always had to be some back and forth, and as such, the president's budget on seemingly non-political matters like IT spending was a decent barometer. This year, I'm not sure that's the case.
What do we watch as the budget process unfolds, then, if we're thinking about where we want to look for opportunities, where we want to try to get in ahead of somebody else, get an edge?
Well, I think what you want to do is look for some emerging areas. You want to look beyond, if you're in IT, for example, the traditional things like cloud and mobility and things of that nature. They're certainly going to be important, but things that have to do with data analytics are going to become increasingly important. Cybersecurity was and is important. It's important to understand, Francis, what the priorities of some of the new leaders on the Hill are and what they're not, because you're going to see spending shaped around those priorities. Anything that's deemed non-national security, for example, is much more susceptible now to being reduced or eliminated than it may have been last year.
Another item you're writing about in the newsletter this week is the way the Pentagon looks workforce-wise, and how you should pay attention to that as far as planning how you're going to go about trying to do business with the Pentagon. What's the deal there?
Interesting point is that the civilian workforce in the Pentagon is and has been shrinking, Francis, and the result is that DOD is left with fewer people in the civilian ranks, more people in the uniform service, and more contractors. My point in the newsletter was to talk about the uniformed military people that companies may now find themselves sitting in front of when they're going to discuss federal business, whereas in years past, they might have been sitting down with a civilian DOD worker dressed in a coat and tie or other business attire, just like they were. Now you're much more likely to be discussing that business with a uniformed service member, as each service wants to hold on to as many active duty slots as it can. They're talking about putting more and more active duty military people into positions that had previously been done by civilian DOD workers. Interesting feedback I've gotten on that article, Francis, from a couple of contractors is A, you're right, Larry. B, the uniformed military people, in addition to having a different ethic and a different ethos, also have different basic knowledge level of the subject matter. So some of the companies are telling me that they're experiencing more of a learning curve on the part of the people they're sitting across the table from.
You also write, this I think is interesting, who else might you see at the negotiation table? Another contractor.
Well, and that's exactly right. Like many people in the Washington area, I do spend some time in front of government agencies on behalf of people that I work with in industry. And in fact, earlier this week, we were in a meeting at a government agency where about half of the people there were contractors and half were actual badged employees of the agency. So you have to understand who it is you're talking to, who has the authority to actually bind the government to a deal. Hint, it's not the contractor. On the other hand, the temptation on part of a company in that meeting might be to want to talk to the contractor more, because on average, that contractor that's embedded in the federal agency is much more responsive than the actual GSer they're working with.
Another item, you did something this week that I've been wanting you to do for a long time, and that is that you have opened the mailbag, the week ahead mailbag.
It's not every week, but...
No. And your correspondent writes, our company wasn't sure if our new product was trade agreements compliant. Our CO said during a phone call that she thought it was. Can we proceed?
The answer to that opinion is worth the paper it's written on, Francis. And when you're looking at things, whether it's Trade Agreements Act or any other matter of government contracting, contractors should never rely on the oral opinion of a contracting officer, because most of the contracts that you're entering into these days are multi-year in nature. That contracting officer could be transferred next year. The person who's negotiating your company's contract may or may not be with the company in 2 or 3 years when that comes up for renewal. Now, there's no record of that conversation. In the case of an audit, you might have some explaining to do. What I recommend is that people get it in writing.
That's good advice pretty much anywhere in this entire space, isn't it?
It is, but you'd be surprised at how many people said, well, the contracting officer told me I could. Contracting officers are fine people. They really are. They work hard, but they don't always remember every discussion they've had with every contractor, particularly today when most contracting officers work with a variety of companies. Similarly, Francis, it's difficult to get an affirmative determination out of a contracting officer. So one of the things I recommend that companies do is craft an email to the CO in such a way that says, we understand that our analysis of this matter is correct. Please let us know if you feel differently. And put that email in your contract file so that you have the history there, and chances are the contracting officer won't reply. If they do, that's great. But if they don't, while that's not 100% guarantee that you won't get in trouble in a negative audit situation, it certainly is a mitigating factor that you can point out to that you at least tried to show responsibility.
I think the technical term, the acronym for that is CYA, right?
I think that's right. And I do believe that's in the Federal Acquisition Regulation.
If, you know what? If it's not, it should be.